It's been part of our tradition for a while now to provide an opportunity for those who've been on a significant residential retreat to have a chance to talk about their experience. It's useful to be able to talk about these things afterwards with an informed audience because a lot of what goes on in a retreat is not really fully connected. When you think out about it, think out loud about it, talk about it, maybe respond to questions, starts to connect the dots. So that's really important and useful. And the other important result can be that people who are participating in the meeting might be inspired in terms of going on the retreat or a retreat themselves, or maybe this retreat, which is up in Georgia. So I'm looking forward to hearing your comments and insights about your retreat experience, Leslie.
Thank you, Peter. I'm happy to be here and share them because you're absolutely right. This is a good, wonderful opportunity for me just to try to articulate some of what I experienced on the retreat, and hopefully in my doing that, it will be useful to you guys too. I've got quite a lot of material here. I've got a text that I'm going to be working from, but I'm eager to get into conversation with you all too. So I will be vigilant about the time. And if I have to cut this short, we'll just cut it short. But I am going to do some reading of sections of my notes here just for to keep me on track. I have a tendency to go off on tangents. So I'll try to be better about that tonight. So thank you all for having me here. I'm happy, so happy to be back in town and back to the Sangha. So I'm going to give you an overview tonight of what my experience was. After 11 days of silent retreat in a remote rural compound of South Georgia, all retreatants assembled in the meditation hall from 4:30 to 6:30 a.m. to hear one last discourse from S.N. Goenka, who was the teacher, on video, not in person, but the teacher and the founder of the Southeast Vipassana Center and of many, many Vipassana centers around the world. And also, in this very last session, in addition to the discourse, we got treated to a pretty heavy dose of his chanting. And I had a very difficult time with the chanting in this course. So we had to endure on this last morning session, or very early in the morning, 4:30 to 6:30, as I said, a long period of chanting, which he offers these chants every sit that we would do. Every meditation would include a pre-chant and a post-chant. And after 11 days of hearing these chants, I just couldn't take it anymore. At five, oh no, what was it? It was probably like 4:50 or 4:55 a.m. by this time, I just kind of lost it for the first time in the whole retreat. And it was just so annoying to me. And maybe it was the early hour. I'm trying to make excuses here. Maybe I was anticipating my drive home, which was imminent. But my state of equanimity in that last session was fairly shattered. Irritation ran high, and I just berated myself. Have you learned nothing about reactivity, Leslie, in 11 days of retreat? The thick Indian accent, Goenka is from Burma. The low voice with a really serious glottal fry. If you don't know what a glottal fry is, let me demonstrate. It's where you're really making your vocal cords vibrate, a tendency that many young people these days have in their speech. So that glottal fry, the dramatic delivery, all of it just grated. And of course, his chanting is in Hindi, so there's no way you can identify with the meaning of what he's saying. You really just have to focus on the sound of what he's saying. So on this last day, it went on for 25 minutes. I timed it, 25 minutes of chanting. Eventually, my desire to be a halfway good yogi won out, and I did endure it. I won't say I came to enjoy it, but I did endure it. Of all the challenges presented on being on a silent retreat, this practice of the chanting was the most challenging for me, and it's something I'm really going to have to explore and think about for a while, and maybe get some assistance from Peter, some psychotherapy from Peter. I've said that now. I've made my complaint about it. I feel so relieved to have that off my shoulders. But still, there I was after 11 days of meditating, irritated, and I was disappointed in myself. It was shocking to me. Was I a failed student, I thought? Had I failed the lesson of my retreat experience? And fairly quickly, I said, no, you did not fail at all. I'm here to say that getting annoyed is not the issue. Getting annoyed is being a human being. Annoyance happens. It's being unaware, reactive, and intolerant of being uncomfortable that constitutes a failure in a contemplative practice. That, for me, was the lesson. After getting through the last bout with annoyance, I left the retreat center after packing the car in pouring rain. I was not irritated. The whole campus was flooded because out of 12 days, the 12 days that we were there, it rained 10 of those days. I was not irritated. Imagine 100 people who have not had coffee in 12 days, trying to get their rooms cleaned, retrieve phones and keys from registration, pack cars, and leave the campus by 7 a.m. that morning. I was not irritated. I finally made it out of the retreat at 7:19 a.m. and drove through a couple of miles of dirt and sand roads that were wet, muddy, slippery, and quite frankly, very dangerous before I reached pavement. It was an appropriate exit, a test of one's equanimity. I was heading home, not at all irritated. After the mud, the drive was easy and joyful because I knew I was on my way to a good cup of coffee. Coffee I would drink very mindfully. It stopped raining when I hit I-95 south, the sky brightening, clouds billowy. The Sunday traffic was light. I felt so grateful for that. I stopped just outside of Jacksonville to get a large coffee and two egg bites with bacon and Gruyere cheese. Remember, I've been on a vegetarian vegan diet for 12 days, headed right for the bacon and the coffee. Oh, what an indulgence that was. After 12 days of bland vegan food and chai tea, my taste buds were thrilled as I hit the road for Winter Park, coffee in hand. Okay, I may be presenting a pretty pathetic sight of a retreatant here. I was home by 10:45 that day and spent the day slowly unpacking and doing laundry and pacing myself intermittently by sitting down with more coffee. 12 days without coffee, people, do not judge me. I drank a lot of coffee on that Monday. And reading the New York Times, I felt the need to catch up. So the good news was the world did not explode while I was gone. I always sort of have that feeling when I go away for a longish period of time that when I come back, everything's going to be different. The world will be in chaos. Something will have gone wrong. But I was relieved and somewhat surprised we were all still here intact. But if the end of times had arrived, I would have never known it because at the beginning of a silent retreat, you have to turn in your phone, your computer, your car keys, your notebooks, any books you may have, to the registrar, known to some of us as the jailer. You are literally imprisoned in a compound, and that was Goenka's word, not mine. He used the word you are imprisoned here. You are literally imprisoned in a compound nestled in a beautiful pine forest in southern Georgia. No exit. For food, you are offered rice cakes and bean soups and rice and more rice and occasionally quinoa, but everyday rice and overcooked vegetables and tofu prepared in a multitude of ways, all bad. Breakfast was oatmeal, prunes, rice cakes, and bananas. I'm telling you guys, these people are very serious about renunciation of worldly pleasures. Take note. I quite contentedly endured. I may sound like I'm complaining, but I'm not. I'm just making observations for you here. I'm only being slightly sarcastic, really, because this retreat was indeed a very strict and very formal retreat in the classical Buddhist tradition, but also was a remarkable experience, mainly because I, along with everybody else, 99 other people, were forced to give up virtually every form of distraction I have come to love and depend on. And this was one of the shocking revelations. I had no idea how dependent I had become on my books, my writing, my podcasts, all of the delightful things I like to spend my time doing. It can be said that we do live in very interesting times. We surely do, but these times simultaneously overload us with numerous and seductive stimulation, overload us with numerous and seductive stimulations that keep us wired and anxious and driven and overwhelmed and overloaded and excited and revved up and mad and frustrated and deluded and almost always stressed or confused to one degree or another. This is exactly why we go on retreat. In his book called The Art of Living, and I just want to show you the book here, The Art of Living, Vipassana Meditation as Taught by S.N. Goenka. Our teacher in this book says the purpose of the practice is to develop in us the ability to deal with all the vicissitudes of life in a balanced way. We learn to do so in meditation by observing with equanimity whatever happens within ourselves. With this equanimity, we can break the habit of blind reaction and instead choose the most beneficial course of action in any situation. End quote. Over and over, he repeated the word equanimity, anicca, anicca, anicca. I tried to remember this intent as I maneuvered the sloppy and unsafe road that led away from the campus. Rain still pouring, mud spattering my newly waxed car, sky gray and dull, and my heart filled with rich and confusing and empowering experiences. Here's why I think retreat is an important part of my contemplative path. It forces me to examine my own mind, my own intentions, to look at what motivates me and drives me. It reveals a raw truth about what I am and how I inhabit a mind. It's not an endeavor everyone seeks, I know, but I do. It's just another in a long life, 78 years for me now, of putting myself in uncomfortable situations and challenging situations, of allowing me to see myself and others as clearly and honestly as I can. It will take me weeks of journaling to understand what it was like to be so desperately alone with my own whacked out thinking. I have to say here that I really nudged Peter pretty hard before I went to try to see if I could get him to give me permission to take my journal and a pen into the retreat, because I said to him, that's the way I learn. Writing is the way I learn. So I could imagine giving up books. I could imagine giving up TV. I could imagine giving up good food. I can imagine not being comfortable. I could not imagine not writing for 12 days. So that was also another huge challenge for me. And so there I was, as I said, alone with no outlet for dealing with this whacked out thinking process that I endure most of the time. If I found Goenka's chanting unpleasant to my ear, the ruminations of my own chattering mind were even more annoying. For me, a contemplative practice is a way of seeing and experiencing myself with more precision, and certainly with more joy and gratitude. And that far outweighs a petty irritation with a glottal fry in somebody's voice. But boy, my taste buds were so happy to eat those Starbucks egg bites. And now I'm back in the semi-real world of Winter Park with all of its beautiful distraction, full force in action, gallery openings to attend, classes to teach, long dinners and good conversations with friends, concerts at Timaqua, an art class with Bob Smedley, getting back to the Sangha of meditation practitioners every Wednesday night. Oh, I am so lucky to be living such a full and interesting life, and also so lucky to continue my lifelong learning intention to be as present and alive and alone as I can be with all of it. As Zorba the Greek said in that wonderful book named after him, Zorba the Greek, give me the whole catastrophe. That's what I have wanted, and I got it. So I wanted to begin with doing a screenshot that would show you the schedule. Unfortunately, I could not locate it in my material online from Vipassana, but I'm just going to hold this up. And if you can
Can't
see,
read it. We can't read it,
can't
Leslie.
read. No, I don't want it. That's not important that you read. All I want to tell you is that it starts at 4 a.m. when you're awakened by the gong that some person who has had to get up earlier and come around to all of the units and ring the gong, and that it ends at 9:30, and you're busy or you're kept engaged with something all but about 4 hours of the day, which included your eating time, your resting time. So I try to count up the hours. That was one of the things I did to try to distract myself, the hours of actual meditation, because 1 hour a day was the hour discourse that Goenka would give. But I think it was any place on, it varied a little bit on some days, but it was any place from 10 to 12 hours a day of meditating. I've been in a lot of retreats, and I've taken several 5 day and 1 7 day silent retreat, but I have never taken a retreat this long, a silent retreat this long. So there was a lot to be learned for me. So what I want to do is kind of move through the days as quickly as I can without becoming too tedious, because what I'd like to do is take you through what, from this perspective that I have right now, what I see and feel were the primary lessons that I learned. I'm sure this will shape shift as the days go on. As I said, I wasn't able to write during the retreat. And so as soon as I got home and got the laundry started, I sat down at my computer and started writing. And I wrote for about 2 days, just doing virtually nothing else but eating and getting up and walking around a little bit, trying to get as many of the details and memories down as I could. So I picked out about six or seven major events that were affecting to me that I'd like to share with you. And then if we have time in the Q&A and you have deeper probing questions about any of these or other things, I'm more than happy to answer them. So the first joy came right away on the first day, and that was the joy of sitting. The joy of silence, the joy of nothing to do and no one to be. Oh my gosh, I just settled right into the practice immediately. I was thrilled and delighted to be there. And I learned the first of many lessons, that silence is very relaxing. My body relaxed, my mind relaxed. And the freedom of having no responsibility became such a joy. the relief in not having to be polite to make conversation, the delight of not having to be in charge of anything or do anything. We are told after every long sit to take rest. And on the first day, I wondered, just how does one take rest without books, without newspapers, without podcasts, without movies, without writing, without making art? The options for rest on this retreat were slim. Just sit. Just look. Just listen. Feel. Observe stillness. Or sleep. Those were the options. No food allowed in the room, so there's no munching, no snacking, and only two meals provided a day, one at 6:30, a very light breakfast, and one at 11 a.m. No reading aloud, no writing aloud. I didn't ask about drawing, although I did find myself thinking about making a collage, choosing papers, using calligraphy pens. Some of my ruminations included that. My desire to be entertained or productive became so radically clear to me. It was very interesting. And at this point in the retreat, and remember, we're early, it was absolutely evident that there was nothing to do. There was nowhere to go. There was no one to be and nothing to say. Is that a burden or is that a liberation? I felt I was freed from the chains of identity. Just sit, Leslie, do nothing. But wait, my chattery mind would say. Then it would produce a counter argument. Isn't the impulse to make things an important part of what makes us humans, an important part of what we're all about? We want to make things, create things. Not all mental activity is an avoidance of my own self-constructed mind, but some of the activities of mine are actually acts of creation. And at that point, I went down a deep rabbit hole of thinking about the evolutionary stages of development of the human species. I started thinking about Homo faber and Homo sapiens, Homo poietes, man the maker, and trying to make this defense. I've got long notes on this little rant I went on of trying to make a case for creative activity in the mind. See how grasping Leslie was to convince herself that there was some reason to be or to not to quell the mind. There was no reason to not quell the mind. So I'm going to skip over all those notes about ancient Greek and what Homo poietes means. It's quite interesting, but it's a rabbit hole that I went down. I don't need to expose you to it. I did laugh at myself, though, when I caught myself in this esoteric rabbit hole. Then this was early on. I don't remember if it was the first or second day. Doing this kind of thing I was doing with my mind, trying to defend a position that I thought was contrary to what we'd been asked to do. That's a real pattern of mine I've come to understand, not just on this retreat, but before this too. I remember Peter and I talking about this at one of my interviews with him in a retreat at San Pedro a few years ago. It's a pattern, the best I can articulate it. It's a pattern of making counterpoint to conclusions or arguments or positions that I'm presented with that I don't buy into wholeheartedly. I was my major in college was rhetoric, so I'm sort of trained to do that sort of thing. And I can recognize that, but I don't want to use that as an excuse because it is a tendency to be observed closely and to be employed judiciously. And as Peter would say, more practice is necessary. On day two, I was continuing with my ongoing frustration with the nature of these mind wanderings that I have, which, unlike the thoughts about my thoughts about man the maker, are usually unbearably boring, mundane, inane, repetitive conversations I seem to carry on with no one. And when I catch myself lost in thought, I will often be annoyed with myself for doing it. There you go again, Leslie. There you go again doing that. I've not learned a great deal of compassion for myself on that. I asked for relief early on in the course from this kind of rumination because it was not just annoying me and boring me, but it was exhausting me too. I just felt depleted and heavy when I would go into these bouts of rumination. And I kept wondering, why can't you be more clever? Why can't you be more imaginative or creative or even outrageous? At least that would make being lost in thought more interesting. Whew, be careful what you ask for. Because on the second day now, we're just in the second day, at that afternoon came the reverie. That's what I'm calling it, the reverie. Right on cue at 3:15 on the second day. I didn't recognize it at the time. I didn't recognize fully what it was at the time. But that was the point. The hindrances began their full-out display in my mind and body. After suffering a version of the normal chatter of my mind, the reverie occurred. And the reverie was amazing. It was, I can't use any other word but reverie. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't like a subtle, what do they call that? Subtle dreaming. It was a full-out scene of me in a shower with a man. Now, it's an X-rated scene. So I'm not going to tell you what the actual reverie was. I just want to tell you it was lovely. It was incredibly pleasant. It was full out desire on my part manifesting. And when it came to an end, which it did, I don't know how long it lasted. It was quite a while. It was just so real and so tangible. When it came to an end, my first thought was, oh, I want to have that experience. The craving, the grasping was pretty remarkable. And so anyway, there I was, left with this reverie that resonated in my mind for the next 4 days. I'll come back to that in just a little bit. But the point I want to make mostly here is that there was an example in the rumination of my mind, the lost in thoughtness of my mind, of desire in full force, a powerhouse force. Hindrance number one. On day three, I became serious about walking meditation, which is not a part of the Goenka technique. I did not know this because most silent retreats that I've been on, Vipassana retreats, have been sitting, walking, sitting, walking, sitting, walking. In fact, we were told not to do yoga or exercise or jog. We were to spend every moment being aware, being present. I was feeling the effects not just of restlessness, there's another, that's the fourth hindrance. The fourth hindrance came on day three. I felt so this restlessness of the mind, but my body was restless too. I was getting a little bit anxious that I wasn't able to exercise. Restlessness, agitation, the fourth hindrance. I wanted to do some yoga really bad. Why didn't I sneak a yoga mat into the room? I thought. So to disarm this hindrance of restlessness, I became serious about walking slowly and deliberately at all times for the entire rest of the retreat, really watching and feeling the body as I moved. We did not do walking meditations on, as I said, in between sits. We just sat and sat and sat at least 10 hours a day. We sat. By 11 days of sitting, I actually developed calluses on my butt. So, for the sake of my poor bum, I made a commitment to make a walking meditation out of every movement to and from various places. People were scooting along the pathways in anything from a walk run to a saunter, most with heads down. We were not to make eye contact. Many kept their faces stern, furrowed brows, set jaws, very serious people. I became the slowest and the oldest person on campus. Oh, I never made that connection before, the slowest and the oldest. I started leaving my room 20 minutes ahead of any event. And no, under normal conditions, it would take like 3 minutes to walk to your either to the lunch or to the meditation hall. I walked very, very slowly, very, very mindfully. It became a major part of my practice and part of the day that I loved maybe the most. I actually rested as I walked. I kept my head up toward the trees and the sky. I smiled. I breathed slowly and enjoyed examining the breath. And at times, I entered bare awareness, silence, ease, acceptance. Relaxation came through mindful motion. Day four brought sloth and torpor, the third hindrance. You can see they didn't come in the order that they're taught. I struggled all day long on day four with a bobbing head, you know, that feeling, you know, when you kind of fall asleep in a meditation. And I complained to myself that there was not a comfortable chair or bench upon which to relax any place on campus. And maybe that was the reason for my fatigue, because I was sleeping perfectly fine at night. Straight back chairs in the lunchroom and in our private rooms, a humble but serviceable mattress on a small bed. No lounge chairs, no padded chairs, no cushioned chairs for sitting outside or watching the trees. Even in private interviews with the teacher, we kneeled on a cushion before the seated teacher to ask our questions. I became very, very aware of how I cultivate a lifestyle of comfort and delight. And I remembered a saying from a Zen master, Tsingen, I think is the way you say his name. He was the third Chinese patriarch of Zen. And he said, "The path is not difficult for those with no preferences." So this began an ongoing examination of my preferences and how my preferences create a self-inflicted distress. On day five, after 4 days of obsessing over my shower reverie, and I do mean I was obsessing about this. I was trying to figure out the meaning of it. I was just doing all kinds of things of trying to adapt it to my thinking about what was happening. But on day four, I began to feel the ephemeral nature of that reverie. It just was floating away from me, and I couldn't see it anymore. I couldn't quite feel it. Was it a distraction? Was it another desire rising up in consciousness? Or was it a lesson, just another fleeting desire to be dismissed, along with all of the boring proliferations that I usually do? Maybe I thought it wasn't a call to action, but a lesson in impermanence. I let it go. And after day four, the shower reverie never came back. My sitting grew more stable. My mind chatter seemed to lessen. By day six, I was applying Vipassana body scan technique and feeling sensations to my practice. Goenka's technique is like a three-legged stool. This is a metaphor that he used, and I thought a good one. Each leg is necessary to achieve the goal, and he reiterated this over and over. The first leg of the stool took place on our very first session, the first evening we came onto campus, the day before Noble Silence was invoked. And that first leg is sila, or morality, virtue. Abstaining from physical and vocal actions that cause harm to others or oneself. And on that night, we were asked to accept the five precepts. The next leg of Goenka's stool is samadhi or samadhi, concentration. The first 3 days of the practice were devoted completely to concentration practice, concentration on the breath, anapanasati, to develop samadhi or concentration. After grounding our concentration for 3 days, we then on the fourth day moved into vipassana training. This leg of the training is called panya or wisdom, where we learned that conditioning will be released when we are non-reactive to sensation in the body. So he spent quite a long time for let's see, I guess this would have been on the fourth and the fifth day of instructions, giving us directions on how to really do this body scan, where he wants us to really identify sensation in every part of the body. And so we practiced and practiced and practiced doing that. And I was interested in doing it because I wanted to be relieved of conditioning. And you know, he had said, and he says in his book, that when you're doing this focusing on attending to sensation, you're literally disarming the conditioned responses in your mind. And that was the whole thing I really wanted on this retreat. But as I was doing this, and I'm going through this body scan, I'm not accustomed to doing body scan. Really, the only time I've ever done body scan is in yoga nidra. But I'm a diligent student, so I was trying to do exactly what he said to do, but the concept just seemed so illogical to me. I just didn't get the connection between doing this, looking at sensations, trying to really feel sensations, and releasing conditioning. So I had an interview with the assistant teacher. Her name is Leslie Tu, spelled with an S, not a Z. Leslie Rains is her name. And I told her that I was having trouble with the body scan. I was having trouble being motivated to do it because the mechanism of releasing conditioning from simply observing sensations and being non-reactive to them did not seem logical to me. And so here we have another hindrance showing up, doubt raising its head. If we have time, we might go into more detail about this, about how I resisted this idea. It was several days of resistance that went on here, and my, you know, typical habit of wanting to make a counter argument for why I wasn't getting this. But I went back the next day to talk to Leslie again, and I was still ruminating on the enigma of the technique. I was still trying to figure it out, but it just didn't make sense to me. But someplace after day six, I came to grasp the process of noting sensations a bit. It's a way, I thought, of seeing the impermanence of sensation. And this, of course, must be a metaphor. Everything that arises is impermanent. Every physical sensation is impermanent. All things that arise go away, mind and matter. And this means that conditioning can go away too. Ah, I thought, I think I'm getting a little bit closer to understanding this. I still wasn't sure what the release mechanism was, but I could see the connection that was being made. In an earlier session with Leslie, she had said to me, when I asked her what this mechanism was, she sort of chuckled at me. And she said, finally, she said, "I don't know how it works, but it works, Leslie. Trust the Dharma," she said. I wanted to trust. Little by little, my mind was settling. And little by little, my trust was growing. I have often felt compelled to figure out the Dharma, a need to understand it and challenge it. This tendency of mine has certainly presented me with dukkha, but on day seven, it just seemed suddenly okay to let the Dharma do its work on me. I don't know what happened, you guys. The practice worked, I guess. I don't know. But at some point, I just relaxed into that notion of let the Dharma do its work, whether you understand it or not, Leslie. And I felt more at ease. Just as soon as you start feeling at ease in a meditation retreat, another wave will come along, and they had alerted us to the waves that come, the waves of ups and downs, the tendency to feel elated one day and then to feel defeated, the idea that you can figure out one thing, something one day, and then the next day have lost it again. So the up and down, like the waves of the ocean, was, something I was knew would happen. I had been warned about it happening, and I was tolerating it. But day seven was an exciting day because it was oatmeal cranberry cookie day at lunch. Oatmeal cranberry cookies, truly, I kid you not, one of the best cookies I've ever eaten in my life. What a relief after 7 days of miserable culinary experience. I ate four of those cookies greedily. I ate four of them, succumbing to a serious bout of craving and greed. And as I sat there at the end of my lunch with a nice cup of chai, hot chai tea, and eating my last cranberry oatmeal cookie very slowly, I said, I'll take whatever punishment I deserve for this greed. It was such joy. Whew. So there's another example of craving and clinging. As the days went on, my mind chatter continued. I kind of was hoping it would go away. I think it did diminish, but it never really completely diminished. And I was creating workshops in my mind. I was rehearsing conversations. I was trying to figure out how to drop my fix-it tendencies. I was really observing and thinking about and wanting to figure out a lot of different things in the Dharma that were being mentioned in the discourses. And I also was thinking about Goenka's emphasis on working hard. He said this every single night, over and over, work hard. You must work hard. But you know what? I don't really want to work hard. I want effortless effort in my life. And so there I am, you see, making a counter offering to a position that's being presented to me. Contemplations were death of death were with me always, as they always are. So lots of thoughts and contemplation of death. I really wanted to let go of all of this, and I kept hearing Peter say to me in our conversations before I left, he would say to me, just keep letting it all go, Leslie. Just keep letting it go. And I cannot tell you, Peter, how grateful I was for that. I know you've said it many times, but it was in a conversation that we were having together. And I took that as my mantra, my motto, my mission. Just let it go, Leslie. Just let it go. Let the Dharma do its work. And then on the afternoon of the eighth day, the course manager, who is sort of like the right-hand woman to the assistant teacher, Leslie, the course manager came up with a little white piece of paper during one of the breaks between sittings, and she gave it to me, and she said, this is from Leslie. And on this little piece of paper, she had written, I read this quote somewhere and thought of you. Here's the quote. The joy of pure detachment is discovered whenever you are not struggling against the facts of things. Not struggling against the fact of things. I was moved to tears. On day 9, we have been told every evening during Goenka's 7 p.m. discourses to practice diligently, to work hard, to make use of our time here. And this day, day 9, almost the last day of the retreat, felt different. The body sweep just felt different. I don't know why. I was paying attention to it, but I somehow missed the connection of events that brought this kind of release about. It wasn't a contrived feeling. I would like to say more about it, you guys, but I'm not that smart. I'm just not that articulate. I don't yet have the words to explain how that last day of the body sweep, as he calls it, became different for me. It became doable for me. There was no resistance. I got a little teary that day, and I'm getting a little teary now just remembering it, because I couldn't explain it, and I just didn't even try to explain it. It still feels mysterious because I was inexplicably renewed by a joy and a commitment to my practice on that last day. Isn't that odd that you can experience joy, lightness, a new kind of awareness, even while those ruminations are going on periodically? I guess I've sort of thought they would stop and then I would become a different person, a different kind of meditator. So at that point, a really nice peace had shifted for me. And maybe one of these days I'll be able to talk about it more clearly. I am a yogi, as most of you know. I have been a student of yoga and the eight-limbed path for many, many years, and a practitioner of the third limb of the eight-limb path, which is asana, as well as the other limbs, concentration and meditation. And I love the quotation from one of their very early and most influential Ashtanga teachers from India, who said over and over, just practice, and all is coming. During the week, Leslie Raines said to me, let the Dharma do its work. Peter Carlson had offered me a gift. Just keep letting go, Leslie. And S.N. Goenka says, be aware, be equanimous, anicca, anicca, anicca. Teacher and author Mary Rose O'Reilly says, somewhere there is a great mystery that wants to come live in your house and change everything. Ease was with me. There is so much more, you guys, that happened to me on this retreat. We don't have time, and you probably wouldn't be interested. There were lots of lessons, insights, new irritations, new joys, more and more waves, more and more acceptance. But mystery seems to be a good place for us to stop tonight. And I'll take any questions that you may have.
Leslie, let me do a little interview with you.
Okay.
I think that might be beneficial for folks. I've been on several Goenka retreats, and I was actually practicing the body sweep while you were talking. So I have some understanding about it. My first Goenka retreat was probably early 2000s or something like that. So anyway, you said at the end of the retreat that you were very aware of irritation. And One of the things that Goenka talks about is that this practice is, I'm paraphrasing here, it's like trying to peel an onion, get through a layer, and you think you're there, but another layer is there.
Ah, that's good.
And so this is the liberating practice. It's something that happens. I'm thinking of saying it fits and starts. And your experience at the end of the retreat, it could have been joy, but it's just another layer.
Another layer.
And
That's so good.
the
Yeah.
more when we practice the body scanning, we bring a certain kind of detached, interested, intentional investigation into play and use the body sensations as a modality for that. Because when you move your attention from one area of the body to another, there's it's changed. That's what anicca is about. But the thing it's important to recognize is that the sensations in the body change, but the sensations in the mind change. And that's what the target of this is, to be able to recognize how the selfing experience, the conditions of the mind, are constantly changing and insubstantial,
Yes.
absolutely insubstantial.
Yes.
So a lot of what you went through seemed very familiar to me. Not exactly the same kind of thing, but that's why I kept saying to you, keep letting go, keep letting go, keep letting go. And that's what actually what I've been doing while I've been sitting here. I used to sit for 2 hours at a time. My body is not in a condition that readily accepts that these days. So for the last hour, my left hip and butt and leg, back of my leg down to the knee, has been aching. But doing the body scanning is just opening to that with every exhalation, opening, 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 opening. And all around that is just this vibrational field that we can call a body. But it's just an experience. It's
Yes.
the ability to be present for that gradually refines our awareness. You were talking about the fantasies that you were having and how they were fading. That comes about because the sensations in the body, in that routine, that disciplined routine of investigation, takes up energy that would otherwise be dedicated
Oh,
to
yeah.
fantasy. So
Yes.
eventually the fantasy is like, oh yeah, it's there again. So what? I don't care.
Yeah.
The way I've described it is like there's this critter that's lurching off to the side of the stage, used to jump center stage and get all the attention. But now it's there on the side stage, and I don't particularly see it at all be interesting for it to let it on center stage, so it doesn't come center stage.
You know, Peter. That's
That's
so
viraga.
good.
That's viraga.
Yeah, and that sort of diminishing of the image, because it was very much a visual image, and I don't see visuals in my mind, so that was surprising to me. But I kept thinking about something I've heard you say often, about how you are at the point where you know that the chatter is going on, but it's like it's in another room and the door is closed. And that's sort of the feeling, a similar feeling I had as that reverie, as I call it, just faded. It just was still there. You know, it would just every day it was a little bit lighter. You know, the technicolor would go away from it, and it was then it was gone. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to mention about the whole notion of impermanence and how this body scanning works with that, there's a clusters of neural connections in the brain called the salience network. And the salience network basically means what's important to pay attention to now? And it's going on over and over and over again, repetitively, all the time. So the Salience Network is alert for novelty, alert for change, and preoccupied with wanting to keep things the same, but nonetheless alert for change, the way I described it, as friend or foe, food or poison. So the practice, the body scanning practice, and this is also true for the breath awareness. There's an intention to focus attention deliberately. Not the conditioning behind that is wholesome. It is an alternative to the conditioning in the mind, and the Salience Network is involved in both cases, to jump to the latest fantasy or the latest resistance or
Yes.
the latest
Yes.
discomfort, right? So the
Yes.
mind is the Salience Network kind of triggers that interest. But because we've changed the way the brain works with the meditation practice intentionally by moving attention around the body systematically,
Yes.
making it like a protocol, that Salience Network is then dedicated to, well, where's the next area to investigate in the body? And what about now? And what about now?
Yeah.
So that
So good.
changes that whole Salience Network, alerting process. And that's what creates that viraga. The story, the demanding story gets weaker and weaker
Yeah.
because you're chaining yourself to change channels, to have a more skillful tuner operation.
Yeah.
Then the tuner being controlled by greed, hatred, and ignorance, the tuner is more guided by right speech, right action, right, the Noble Eightfold Path.
Right.
So, is that bring any more clarity to your?
Oh, absolutely. I wish you'd been my teacher there and I'd gone to the interview room and have you say that to me. That would have helped so much. Yes, it's very, that's very, that all of that resonates. It's all was quite well said. Thank you.
Marty has a question, and then.
Yes. I just want to tell you, Leslie, that that was so beautiful. I would listen to it over and over and over again. That was so beautiful, and thank you for the way you presented it. Well, thank you very much. I quite frankly, as Peter knows, have been nervous about doing this because, well, just because I respect you guys so much and want to use the time.
I
Well,
just loved it. I totally loved it. So I just wanted to tell you that.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So, Will?
And Leslie, thank you so much. I've also done this course a few times, so just hearing from you was just so lovely and kind of takes you back in a way and got me excited to do my next one and looking forward to the cookies.
Yes. Put in a request for the cranberry oatmeal cookies for sure.
So the one question I have, since most of the since people here haven't done it, is what did you wish you knew about the course before you went, besides the chanting?
Yeah, very, very good question. And I can t tell you exactly what. I wish I had read this book twice before I went. Now, Will is the person who turned me on to this book when he knew, found out that I was going to the retreat. And so I reread this book when I got home. That was my third reading of it. And all of a sudden, there's so many things that Goenka said and did made sense. There were things that I had highlighted and then long passages that I had no highlights at all because I don't think I understood what he was saying, especially when it came to the body scan. So I think if I had, now I don't know, that may be me just kind of falling into my old academic tendencies, but the room was filled with young people. The room, the women's side was about I would say more than 50% of 60% of the group were in their 20s. 20s or maybe, yeah. I said to Peter when we talked yesterday, I said, if I ever felt worried about the world, I do not now. To think that 100 young people, there weren't all, they weren't all young. I mean, there were a variety of ages, but there was just in the women's side, there was a preponderance of youth there. And
Leslie, to be efficient with time.
oh yeah, sorry. Go ahead. Any other questions?
Well, yeah, Steve wants to share with us, but what I would suggest to you, Leslie, read the book two more times and go on another retreat.
Yes, I plan to. I
Wow.
think I can't. I've put in now. I really need to go to another retreat. I'm really ready now to go to another retreat.
Yes. Steve.
A different retreat, Leslie?
No, I think I'll do another Goenka retreat. Maybe a 3 day.
Sounds somewhat
No,
punishing.
no, 7 days, 7 days,
7 days.
11 days, excuse me.
Anyway, I've got a few questions, and we can cover this another time too. But what was the significance then of the long chants?
Oh, that's a great question. Will might be able to answer that, or Peter. I do not know because
Yeah,
it was
let me comment about that once again for time management. Those chants were not in Hindi, they were in Pali, which is
oh.
the Theravadan, it's equivalent to Latin for the Catholics.
Okay.
And so the intention of the chant is to organize, my assumption, the energy that's coming from the teacher to the student. And the I understand some of the content of the chants, and I can appreciate it for the intention that's embedded in the chant. A lot of it's repetition of a sutra.
Yeah.
And so that's what the whole notion is about. But it is a well-respected way to cultivate stable attention.
Yeah.
But your practice should be that you can work with whatever comes up, just like that other Leslie suggested in the note, you know,
Yes.
that you're dealing with the facts. And the
Yeah.
facts in that case was that there's sound.
Yeah.
And the other fact is your mind's making something of it that
Yes.
is reactive and unwholesome.
Well, it was
So,
what
let
it was
it
a,
go.
yeah, it was a classic example of a fairly instilled preference I have for people speaking in a certain way. And he was not speaking in a way I wanted him to speak. So, it was entirely my fault. I knew that,
No,
but
it's your karma.
it's my karma.
That's your sankhara. That's
It's
one thing I
definitely.
want to say about it. And then I
Yeah.
think you need to wrap things up because we've been going a long time.
Okay. So sorry.
One other quick question
All right.
then. On
Stephen.
the Goenka dissertations, were those just played audio or
Yes.
video?
No, it was a video. So it's a big video screen on the wall in front of us on the hall, and it's so they just run this. I don't know when he died, like
5 years ago,
2017
something like that.
or yeah, maybe I don't know, 5 or 8 years ago. But he's still in living color there, and in one of his retreat centers, and giving these very intense and fast-paced and heavily embedded with all kinds of information, very articulate, very funny at times, and I loved the discourses. I really enjoyed it. It was a break from the meditation.
Yeah,
And
it's Dharma boot camp, and
yeah.
it's really I've been encouraging people to go to Goenka retreats for decades.
Yeah.
It's really well worth the effort and the commitment to deepen your practice. That was one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, a little fun fact. I was poking around the internet and went to the Insight Meditation Society website, And there were some photos there of Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg when they first started. And it turns out that they met, Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg are co-originators with Jack Kornfield of the Insight Meditation Society in the mid-70s. But anyway, Joseph and Sharon met at a Goenka retreat. I
Oh,
did not know until today.
I did not know that either. Interesting.
Yes.
Are they
No,
alive?
no, 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 okay, so we've reached the end of our time tonight. So, as is our custom, let's sit together briefly. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well, and hope that we have a reasonably safe and pleasant life till the next time we have a chance to chat.